Bonjour à tout le monde. Je m'appelle Gunnel Ekroth, je suis professeure en archéologie classique et histoire ancienne à l'Université d'Uppsala. Et je voudrais commencer par remercier le Collège de France et surtout le monsieur John Scheid pour m'avoir invité pour donner des conférences ici. Et ma première conférence était la semaine dernière. Et pour cette conférence, j'ai parlé en français. C'est une langue qui est très difficile pour moi. Il faut que je le dise. Mais aujourd'hui, je suis vraiment désolée, mais je vais parler en anglais parce qu'à cause des problèmes logistiques, je n'ai pas pu trouver quelqu'un pour traduire mon texte. Je suis vraiment désolée, mais j'espère que ça n'a pas posé trop de problèmes pour vous. J'imagine pas. Mais je vais parler très lentement, pas comme je parle en suédois, lentement, et j'ai beaucoup d'images. Donc. On va se débrouiller, j'imagine. Et pour les questions, je peux les répondre en français. Et je comprends très bien le français aussi. Donc. Greek gods had their allotted spaces where worship took place, called temenos, that which has been cut off. Sometimes gods contributed actively themselves to setting apart this land. Leto does so for her son Apollo, in the Homeric hymn of Apollo, when she swears that her son will have an altar, a bomos, and a temenos on the island of Delos, and this is a way for getting the island to accept her giving birth there. Usually, in the cases where our sources inform us what the gods actually want, gods ask for rich temples and altars, not for plots of land. They want the places where they actually can be worshipped. The dedication of a temenos to a god rather seems to have been a human undertaking, not very different from the handing out of land when colonies were founded. And at those occasions, of course, also particular precincts for gods were established. Plato says explicitly that statues, altars, and temples are to be given for each of the gods, and also that they should have a temenos each marked off for them. Inscriptions also state that temene are set apart and installed for gods, and often with altars on top of them. Such pieces of land were the property of the god. This is important to remember. And just as anything owned by somebody, it was up to the owner to decide how it was to be used. And since the owner in this case is a god, the land was circumscribed by special rules. But a temenos was not exclusively frequented and visited by the divine owner. In fact, mortal visitors may have used this space just as intensely as the gods did, or perhaps even more so, though in a different manner and for different reasons. Human beings were also the caretakers and the administrators of the god's property. This raises a number of questions as to how we should understand and characterize the relation between the god and his or her temenos as being their property, and what this relation in its turn reveals about what the god Greek notion of the divine. My prime interest lies in the relation between the god as the owner of a temenos and human worshippers and visitors as keepers of this divine property. My starting point is the fact that sanctuaries are spaces set apart for gods, but mainly used by men. How did this affect how these locations were planned, what kind of buildings you erected, and how they were equipped? Whose interests, needs and concerns were the more prominent ones in a sanctuary? It's too simple to say that the divine perspective alone directed the use of a temenos, nor the presence of the human worshippers was the decisive factor. Instead, we meet an intricate mix of immortal and mortal practices and manifestations, both as to quantity and quality, that had to be accommodated within this space. This inquiry, in its turn, touches upon another major issue, no less complex, of course, namely the distinction between sacred and profane within Greek culture. And this is a really, really difficult and tricky question. But the temenos and the more intense study of this concept, its definition and use, could hopefully serve as a test case for a better understanding of these categories. I will start also by saying that this paper is part of a more comprehensive ongoing study dealing with something I have labeled the profanity of the sacred, dealing with sanctuaries. And I may raise perhaps more questions than I will provide distinctive answers at this stage. In any case, I will in particular focus on two issues I find relevant at this stage. First of all, the marking of boundaries for temene, and secondly, the handling of purity and pollution of a temenos, and what that meant in practice when human worshippers frequented Greek sanctuaries. But first, a few words on the terminology. It's generally agreed that the term temenos comes from the verb temno, to cut off or to separate. And this means a piece of land that has been cut off and assignated as an official domain. It's not private in the same sense anymore. In particular, the word refers to land marked off from common use and dedicated to the gods. We actually meet the term already in the Mycenaean Linear B documents, but here it does not seem to have any religious connotations and instead covers the territory of the Vanax, one of the ruling persons in the Mycenaean society. In Homer, temenos is used for a defined set-off area, though not necessarily religious, but a god's place of worship can be described as his temenos and his fragrant bomos, his well-smelling altar. As is the case with several sanctuaries in Homer, for example, Zeus' precinct on Mount Ida. And this is also the exact expression that we encountered in the Homeric hymn to Apollo when Leto asks for a temenos and a fragrant bomos. No, she will say that she will give that to her son on Delos. And actually, this combination of a plot of land, a temenos, and an altar, bomos, corresponds well to the appearance of the earliest Greek sanctuaries of the Iron Age, for which a temple building was not a prerequisite. In the Archaic period, the connection to the gods became more prominent and very central, and temenos is explicitly linked with a divine plot of land, and this is the same use we have in the classical period. A slight but interesting widening of the semantic field takes place in the Hellenistic period, when temenos can also be used for a funerary precinct, especially one of scale and importance that implies some kind of heroic cult. The size of these precincts is evident from a number of cult foundations, for example, the temenos of the heroine established by Epicteta on Thera for the cult of her husband and son in around 200 BC. A less well-known but very instructive case is a temenos of a person called Antigonos of Cnidos, dating to 282 before Christ. And this precinct had a sekos, some kind of building, a tumele, probably an altar. It had a dromos, with a palestra, this is an installation for sports events, and a bath. These funerary heroic temene, both gods and mortals, could be worshipped. But my focus here today lies on the temenos of archaic, classical, and Hellenistic period, and used in the cult of gods and heroes, not of heroic mortals. But temenos is not the only term used for divine land, and instead forms part of a complex terminology, which has, of course, been commented by many scholars. What I'm interested in is the plot of land set apart for gods and belonging to them. this would be called temenos, but it's not necessarily so in all cases. A range of other words occur in connection with this kind of space. We have alsos, which means a sacred grove. We have Abaton, a place you cannot step on, sekos, kind of building or an enclosed precinct, and Peribolos, a fenced-in or walled-in area, and the most complex one, Hieron. The terminology is intricate and far from clear-cut, as is always the case with Greek terms pertaining to religion. Chronological and geographical variations also have to be taken into account. And there is no room for a fuller discussion here, but a few comments should be made on Peribolos and Hieron in connection to Temenos. Peribolos is the neutral term for a wall enclosing an area, and it doesn't have to be sacred. And also the term toichos, simply wall, can be used. And this is the terminology for the wall around the Hieron on Apollo of Delos. A peribolos can mark the outer limits of a temenos, but can also be set up around an abaton or a hieron. And on this wall of the peribolos of the temenos, you can inscribe decrees and laws and various things you need. A more intricate relation is between hieron and temenos, as both imply some kind of sacred quality of the ground. There is an overlap between the terms, but still they are distinct entities. Hieron is the broader one. It can designate a sanctuary more generally, but also a temple or even a part of a temple, while temenos is the plot of land, though the term can be used for the entire sanctuary as well. An often evoked example is a late 4th century decree from Ialisos on the island of Rhodes, dealing with the purity of the sanctuary of Alectrona. And this stipulates that you're not to bring forbidden items, things or clothing, into the Hieron and the Temenos. But at one point, this law particularly mentions only the Temenos. And this is when it speaks about that horses, donkeys, mules, and other equids are prohibited, as well as people wearing pig skin shoes. And central here is apparently the Temenos as the actual ground on which, of course, both animals and people with pig skin shoes will tread. And the wrong kinds of beings and items touching the soil will result that both the Hieron and the Temenos have to be purified. The distinction between Hieron and Temenos in the sense that the first one is a cult-related building and the second one a piece of land is also found in documents pertaining to the lease of God's land, usually for agricultural purposes. The land designated by Temenos is rented out, and it seems clear that most land belonging to gods, in fact, could be used for farming. A well-known late 5th century decree from Athens of the sanctuary of Kodros, Neleus, and Basile stipulates that the Hieron is to be fenced in and the Temenos belonging to Neleus and Basile is to be leased out. And this plot of land cannot have been too small, as the person who got the lease was supposed to plant no less than 200 small olive trees inside it. From this very brief review, we can conclude that the Temenos was linked to the ground, or rather was the ground, and that it had a notion of being set apart, that is, having some kind of boundary. The question is, what kind of boundary? Is it a physical or a metaphysical one? And what purpose did this boundary serve? Demarcations of cult places are mentioned in inscriptions and texts, so we know they existed, but were they always walls? There were many ways of demarcating sacred space in ancient Greece. A physical peribolos, a wall, was one, but fences could also be made of stone or wood, or stone and wood together. You could have boundary stones, horoi, perirantheria, vessels for purifications, and even statues, monuments, and vegetation could be used. A wall was not the only option. There is surprisingly little discussion in scholarly literature of markers of Temenos borders, and concrete visible Temenos walls are often taken as a prerequisite of a Greek sanctuary. And many publications dealing with Greek cult places refer to there having been a Temenos wall, whether or not any traces of it have actually been found. It's assumed that the Temenos had to have a wall, a peribolos. A good example is Birgitta Bergqvist's study, The Archaic Greek Temenos, from 1967. And here, the existence of a delimited temenos is taken as a basic given feature, but there is little discussion of its physical manifestation at the sites she covers. And neither does she comment on any chronological or geographical variations as to the occurrence of such walls. The actual presence of a wall should not be taken for granted. Some temene had them, others did not. Thucydides remarks that the fugitives during the Peloponnesian War who came to Athens took up residence in the sanctuaries, hiera, and the hero shrines, heroa, which could not be securely locked, the bios kleston, that is, those that were not walled in and had proper gates. And Thucydides specifically points out that people could not enter and occupy shrines that had walls and gates, such as the Acropolis and the city Eleusinion. The material properties of a temenos border therefore need to be explored, in particular when and how it was deemed necessary to physically demarcate such a precinct, and if such a physical boundary was a divine or a human desideratum. At many sanctuaries, we simply don't know if there ever was a wall, as the outer limit of the site is not excavated, or the archaeological context indicates that the wall was robbed in later time, so the extent cannot be completely established. In other sanctuaries, the cult was up and running for a considerable period of time before it was deemed necessary to build a proper wall. Even the main temple could predate the Temenos wall with a substantial period of time. And Olympia is a good case in point. Here, the cult of Zeus was established already in the middle of the 11th century, and the earliest temple, the so-called Horaion, which might be dedicated to Hera or to Zeus, dates to the Archaic period. The Greek Perybalos wall, marked in red here, is, according to the latest investigations, no earlier than the mid-4th century BC. So it's even later than the great Temple of Zeus that's erected around 475. Apparently, there was no need for a proper wall around the precinct, the Altis, for more than 500 years, even though this was a major pan-Hellenic sanctuary. But the opposite development can also be found. The sanctuary of Poseidon at Isthmia had an early temenos wall that dated to the first half of the 7th century, erected at the same time as the temple and the long altar east of the temple. Interestingly, after the temple burnt the first time in 470 before Christ, and the sanctuary was restored, the archaic temenos wall was torn down and the foundation trench filled in. When the classical temple was built, a new propylon was constructed, but the temenos wall on the northern side was not. The sanctuary may now on that side only have been marked by boundary stones by Horoi. The question then follows, why do some temene have walls? And here, of course, a number of overlapping reasons can be found that relate both to religious and practical aspects of the sanctuary, but also to both the divine and the human perspectives. Of major importance is the local situation, although some overriding concerns may be distinguished. Why the wall is so late at Olympia, we really don't know, at the present stage at least. At Isthmia, the archaeological record can give us an indication of why the earlier sanctuary had a wall while the later one had not. The northern section of the archaic temenos wall followed the route from Isthmus, the narrow passage of land between the mainland and Peloponnesos, to Corinth. And this placement of the road along the route may have served a very particular purpose at this sanctuary. In this area, a great number of fragments of archaic helmets, shields, and cuirasses were found, And the excavators have suggested that these are remains of military dedications that could have been displayed on top of this wall to be clearly seen by everybody coming to the sanctuary from this side, but also those passing by on this very trafficked route. In the archaic period, Isthmia was in fact, after Olympia, the most prominent sanctuary for commemorating victories in war and offering military votives. In the classical period, the practice of dedicating armor at Isthmia had stopped, and the previous use of the Temenos wall as a display for votive offerings was apparently no longer relevant, and therefore boundary stones may have been enough. The archaic Temenos wall at Isthmia could be seen as a part of a desire to monumentalize the site by its use for showing off arms and armor. But the Temenos walls themselves can also be seen as a conscious attempt to monumentalization, just as the rise of stone temples in the archaic period has been explained as a part of the same kind of process to make sanctuaries more grand and impressive. At the Argive Heraion in the Argolid, the fake Mycenaean terrace, constructed to look as if it was a Bronze Age remain, dating to the late 8th century, has been taken as representing the earliest extent of the sanctuary, the Temenos. But this terrace wall also provided the necessary space for cult activities and buildings, and clearly monumentalized the area. And everybody who's been to the Argolid know that you see this terrace from far, far away. The remains of the archaic temple preserved on top of the terrace, and this temple is built around 650, 625 BC, only used a part of this space, although some kind of naiskos may have existed earlier, if we judge by the terracotta model found at the Argive Heraion. At Olympia, the terrace wall to the south of the early 5th century temple of Zeus was probably first erected as a landscaping measure to accommodate the later and very, very large temple. Later, in the mid-4th century, it was crowned by a wall. Still, this Greek Temenos wall was apparently not more than a meter high. The Roman Temenos wall, however, at Olympia, was something completely different, as it seems to have stood 3 to 4 meters in height. And this is a wall, is a true monument by itself. But also the Artemision at Ephesus had a wall that towered more than 3 meters in the Roman period. It was crowned by a molding and used for the display of inscriptions. This wall was actually found standing in one in the southwest corner at the earliest investigations of the site. This is why we have these drawings actually showing what it looked like. But of course, it was soon robbed by the local inhabitants. And today, there are no remains of it whatsoever. Even the georadar investigations cannot pick it up. Possibly, these very, very substantial Temenos walls are to be seen as a later development of a Greek sanctuary, part of a Roman embellishment or a Roman tradition, but that remains to be further investigated. A major reason for having a wall must have been to regulate access to the Temenos, even if it was not a prerequisite at all sanctuaries, and such needs certainly varied over time, as is evident from Olympia. Certain types of cults made it necessary to control who could enter the sacred area, as only some people were allowed in. At Eleusis and other mystery cults, the wall and the entrance that could be closed off prevented those not initiated or not entitled to partake in the ceremonies from entering and from seeing. Many incubation cults, you paid a fee before the consultation of the deity. And in those cases, the wall could have kept those out who had not paid their ticket, their entrance fee, but also the wall assured a calm consultation of the deity for those that were incubating inside the sanctuary. One example is the Amineion at Athens. This is a small cult place for a local healing hero of the 5th century. It had apparently a wall around it to shield the worshippers, and presumably there was some kind of incubation going on here. But the sanctuary was also located in the middle of a residential neighborhood full of private houses around it. And the walls may even be more necessary in this case to safeguard the secluded nature of the cult. A particular case is formed by some hero cult shrines that were surrounded by walls to prevent the wrong kind of people from entering and from actually worshipping, especially if the cult was located in a sanctuary visited by many. On Delos, the sanctuary of the local hero Anios or Archigetes was completely surrounded by a wall in the 5th century, and above the entrance an inscription read, "Foreigners are not allowed to enter." The early 5th century enclosure and propylon around the Pelopion at Olympia, the sanctuary of the hero Pelops, may also have been triggered by such motives, namely to keep the foreigners out. In the classical period, Pelops had become some kind of national hero for the city-state of Elis, that is the community that controlled the sanctuary of Olympia. And this may have caused the cult to be reserved for Elean citizens only. And this then became a pressing need with this very busy international sanctuary, and a wall and a gate that could be closed were erected. A similar situation can be found at Nemea, where the Heroon had a wall already in the Archaic period, but there doesn't seem to have been a wall around the sanctuary of Zeus. We really don't know. There are some Horoi around, but it's difficult to tell. We can note that the Pelopion had a wall at least 150 years before the Altis received its first Temenos wall, while at Nemea, the sanctuary of Zeus only seems to have been marked by Horoi. Some smaller enclosures, labeled Abata, could not even have, sometimes even had an entrance at all, perhaps since they were too holy. A fragment of Euripides' tragedy Erechtheus gives us an interesting insight into this mindset. Athena here instructs Erechtheus' wife, Praxitea, that the Temenos, where their dead daughters are worshipped and presumably also buried, is to be an abaton, and that the Athenians are to keep it safe so that the enemy cannot come there and make offerings and assure victory in battle. The walls prevents the cult from being manipulated. The safekeeping of the god's property, votives and other valuables could also call for a wall. Diodorus Siculus remarks that the sanctuary of Hemitea at Castabos in Caria was not plundered by the Persians, even if it was unwalled at Teichiston. The walls around the Pelopion at Olympia and the Heron at Nemea could also have served in particular to safeguard the hero's bones from being stolen. In hero cults, this poses a very particular problem because the power of the hero resides in the bones. You take the bones, you get the power with you. And we know of these thefts of bones in antiquity. The walling in also prevented misuse of a Temenos, particularly from people staying there unlawfully, as happened in Athens during the Peloponnesian Wars. The fencing in of the Hieron and Temenos of Kodros, Basile, and Neleus that I mentioned in the beginning has been interpreted as an attempt to reorganize the situation in Athens after the war when things were really messy and get rid of any people squatting, I mean staying illegally in sanctuaries, and also making sure that they could not return by fencing these shrines in with a wall and leasing them out to a person. An interesting case of protecting the god's property by a wall is the situation at the Hephaestion at Athens on the west side of the Athenian Agora. The temple was constructed in the 440s, but the earliest Temenos wall dates to the early 3rd century, though there are some traces of a late 5th or early 4th century construction, but we don't know how extensive it was. The reason for the sturdy wall of the 3rd century around the precinct, almost 200 years after the temple was built, in fact, can be connected to the installation of two rows of potted plants and trees in the area between the temple and the wall. The Hephaestion was surrounded by a garden. The actual area enclosed around the temple is not very substantial, and there is little space between the flower pots. This means that some activities, such as feasting, must have taken place outside the temenos, presumably to the area south of the temple, where the bedrock had been leveled flat in the 4th century. The elaborate and highly unusual garden, because this is a unique example, apparently needed to be protected, perhaps especially from the partying crowds at the festivals, and the temenos wall would then assure that no damage was done to the trees and the bushes. Another example of how the temenos wall relates to both divine property and activities of the human worshippers is the sanctuary of Poseidon at Calavreia on Poros. In the earliest phase, the early 6th century BC, it consisted of a low wall enclosing an area around 50 by 20 meters. It was entered from the southwest by a propylon with two columns. Finds of roof tiles inside this enclosure suggest that there must have been some kind of structure here already in the early 6th century, perhaps a small naiskos, but no proper stone architecture. And presumably there was also an altar. In the second phase, in the end of the 6th century, a stone temple was constructed within this enclosed precinct, and it took up most of the space inside. At the same time, the open area to the southwest of the enclosure was demarcated by a particular building, a propylon, down here. The presence of this propylon, which is actually one of the earliest that we have in Greek sanctuary context, suggests that the area in between the former enclosure and the propylon now constituted a substantial enlargement of the temenos, and also a formalization of how to enter it. In the classical period, the open area was bordered by stoas, and in the Hellenistic times, there might have been a temenos wall to the south. The reasons for extending the temenos at Calavreia could have been many. The first walled-in temenos, early 6th century, was of course used for the cult of the god, apparently sacrifices, the position of votives, but perhaps also for the meals of the worshippers. When the larger stone temple was erected, this area became too restricted and too small for both divine and human activities. Some of these activities that earlier took place inside this wall, such as dining, had to be moved. This interpretation is supported by the finding of a dump outside the earlier wall, with late archaic, possibly early classical pottery and miniatures, and both burnt and unburnt bones. This could represent the cleaning out of activities inside this wall in connection when the stone temple was built in the late 6th century. The unburnt bones are particularly interesting, as they cannot represent the part sacrificed to the gods, but rather remains of meals for the worshippers. In the second phase, the late 6th century, the banquets after the sacrifices were moved outside the former wall in order to provide the necessary space. And the propylon to the southwest suggests that this was just not any open area, but the extended temenos, providing ample room for the worshippers' meals. And the importance of this area for banquets, also really big ones, is evident from the find I mentioned last week. Close to the propylon for the temenos, a walled-in deposit was made consisting of pottery, animal and fish bones, an event involving a feast for more than 200 people in the middle of the 2nd century BC. And this was left as a permanent marker next to the entrance of the temenos. At Calavreia, the earlier temenos wall was kept when the temenos was extended. The Heraion on Delos provides a similar but less clear situation. The late 6th century temple of Hera is surrounded by a wall, presumably marking the temenos of the god, of the goddess of that period. Outside this area, an altar was erected in the 4th century BC. And this altar also has a different orientation, but apparently must have belonged with the temple. Does the location of this altar mean that the Temenos was extended in the Hellenistic period, but no new Temenos wall was built? It's difficult to picture the altar of a god outside his or her Temenos. Unfortunately, the archaeological situation at this particular site does not allow us to establish more clearly the relation between walled-in area and altar. Finally, not only votive offerings, heroes' bones and ornamental plants were in need of a fence around the Temenos to prevent people from getting at them. Also, more regular agricultural production had to be protected. The Temenos belonging to the sanctuary of Kodros, Nelos and Basile at Athens was walled in before leased out to safeguard, surely, the newly planted olive trees. and we should not forget here that a wall or a fence could have very, very mundane motives for being there, simply to keep those out who did not understand by themselves that they were to stay away, or who could not read the horoi telling them that they were entering divine space, like these creatures, for example. To control access for cultic reasons and to protect the god's property were major reasons for Temenos walls. But it was the conditions at the individual location and time that occasioned such structures. From a divine point of view, a walled-in Temenos does not seem to have been a prerequisite. As I noted initially, when gods command for sanctuaries to be installed, they usually ask for temples, altars, or hiera, but rarely temene. Of importance was the manifestation of the Temenos as a divine space, but not the marking of its border. It was up to the mortal men to guard this border as they best saw fit. And that depended on what was inside. And sometimes this required a wall. Let us now move inside the Temenos, beyond the wall, if there was one, to consider my second issue, the handling of purity and pollution of the Temenos and what that meant in practice. Humans could and would use divine space, though not for any purpose. A temene could be rented out for cultivation, and agriculture did apparently not clash with proper use in the most cases. But some rental contracts also stipulate that the site has to be used as a sanctuary, and the worshipper must be allowed to come and sacrifice. The Hippocratic sacred disease states, we, that is humans, mark out the boundaries of temples and temene for the gods, so that no one may enter them if he's not pure. And when we enter them, we sprinkle with holy water, not as being polluted, but as laying aside any other pollution which we formerly had. Marking and safeguarding divine property was clearly a human responsibility, but also to keep the Temenos pure. And interestingly, the gods themselves did not have this power. And even if gods could not be polluted by men, at least I don't think so, humans could certainly pollute their temene. We're dealing with different kinds of pollution here, both material and immaterial, from a taint caused by certain actions that cannot be seen, to actual physical impurities lying around the precinct, but also damage to the god's property. Some actions give rise to impurity took place outside the Temenos, and were brought inside with the visitors, while other things would arise once you were already inside. You could be pure when you enter, but still cause pollution inside. And you could also, of course, affect the physical environment. It's here useful to separate between what happened before you enter and the things that in fact can be avoided, and actions inside the Temenos related to the actual cult. The main types of pollutions to be kept away from a Temenos were death, birth, and sex. And it's said in all handbooks of Greek religion that you were not to be born or die in a Temenos, nor to have sex there, because then the area becomes polluted. The foundation for this very assertive statement is less clear than what is often assumed. It's mainly based on what we know to be done if pollution occurred, as well as actions to be undertaken if you were polluted before you enter. And this we find mainly in the inscriptions. And we also have horror stories of people doing these things in sanctuaries and what happens to them. And this is what we find in our literary sources. A definitive ban on death and births in sanctuaries is, as far as I know, only found in an inscription called IG 1035. This is a huge Roman document dealing with the re-establishment of Greek sanctuaries, various kinds of sanctuaries and precincts in Athens. That has engendered a huge literature. And here it's explicitly said that you're not to be born or die in a temenos. But certain indications of these kind of rules are also found in other earlier documents. The gravity of death in sanctuaries is evident from the elaborate and expensive purifications that had to be undertaken. At Delos, a case of a sanctuary where a human corpse had been found and removed, a ram, a bull, and a boar were used for purification victims, and these are unusual and expensive animals. They were subsequently burnt in a huge pyre that was also very, very expensive, more than 4 meters long. And not even sanctuaries of Asclepius dared to take in those that were very sick or about to give birth. And women who had miscarried or just given birth also had to stay away. According to Pausanias, a special building was constructed outside the Hieron of Asclepius at Epidaurus to house pregnant women and those that were very ill. And the Asclepiaeion on Delos was located on a promontory facilitating the quick evacuation of the very sick from the sacred island over to Rhenea. Sex is less clearly banned, and it's rather the precautions you have to undertake after having sex that show that this was non-desired. Herodotus is a good case here. On the other hand, it's also very clear from the reactions of how Demetrios Poliorketes kept a veritable harem in the opistodomos of the Parthenon in Athens, both hetairai and virgins and matrons and whatnot. And this clearly shows that sex was an undesired activity. Preventions against impurities and actions of how to get rid of them relating to birthdays and sex are common in sacred laws and literary texts. But apart from these major concerns, individual sanctuaries could have special rules stipulating conditions of purity. Some of these clearly regard what the god doesn't like, such as the wrong kind of elements to enter the temenos, specific certain sacrificial animals, usually pigs and goats are difficult here, bringing in certain objects and materials, clothing or jewelry. And this was the case of the decree of Alectrona in Rhodes. Worshippers would eat some kinds of foods, or just of the wrong kind, for example, women and foreigners. Transgression of these rules led to impurity, divine anger, and of course, purification. However, none of these things really had to take place in the sanctuary. You could avoid them all if the proper rules were respected before you came in. Also, these kinds of actions did not affect the physical environment of the temenos, the god's property. And here we can distinguish between behavior that the god disapproved of and how his property was handled. And of course, he would disapprove of the second as well. My main interest lies in how the human effects of a temenos, when people visited sanctuaries to actually worship the gods and the problems that this could lead to. What would and could people actually do in a sanctuary, and how did that affect the pure status of the temenos and this domain as a sense of being the god's property? What difficulties would arise? The main complication seems to have been that human existence was clearly not entirely compatible with divine space, since humans need and want to do things that gods don't like. And this leads them to use the temenos in the improper way. And the final part of my presentation will focus on this human impact of cult activities on the temenos. In order to better grasp the relationship between human use of a temenos and the need to keep it pure, we look at the sequence of animal sacrifice, thysia, from entering the temenos to the concluding meal. How was this very central action which involved both gods and men, handled within the framework of the temenos. Animal sacrifice, of course, involves animal victims, but this central element of the ritual, the animals themselves, was far from uncomplicated. Apart from these prohibitions bringing in the wrong kind of animals, and I said usually pigs and goats are the main targets, a number of regulations aim at preventing damage to the god's property, in particular vegetation. Animals are not to be grazed in the temene, since they could eat all the grass, the bushes, and the trees. And they could even be confiscated by the god if they entered, as is a case of Zeus Temenites on Amorgos in the 4th century. And here it's said that any sheep entering here would be made sacred to the god. It's sometimes difficult to distinguish which animals are referred to in these documents. Are they sacrificial animals? Are they flocks owned by the locals? Or are they animals used by the worshippers who travel to the sanctuary? Not if they're sheep, of course. Transport animals may have been a larger problem than what we have previously realized, considering the size of some religious festivals. This concern to safeguard the vegetation of the sanctuary could have lain behind the prohibitions of letting horses, donkeys, mules, and other equids entering the temenos of Alectrona on roads that I mentioned initially. If they were brought into the compound and fed there, the land would just be destroyed. Another different example of what unrestrained animals in sanctuaries can lead to regards the famous Buffonia ritual at the Dipoleia in Athens, as accounted by Porphyry. We're here in the period before the introduction of animal sacrifice. An ox coming back from the working in the fields happens to stray into the sanctuary, and there he eats a cake lying on the altar waiting to be sacrificed to the gods. The ox is killed, problems arise, and eventually there is a cult. But it shows that animals have to be restrained. And the actual restraining of the sacrificial animals is much more organized than what we have realized earlier. The notion of the peaceful, willing victim is a mirage among scholars with little real connection, and this has been clearly demonstrated, for example, by Stella Jurgudi. A number of sanctuaries give evidence for rings to which animals were fastened not cause havoc, especially after the killing had begun and they start smelling the blood. And this is a real problem today in modern abattoirs, that once you kill one animal, the others will know they're going to die, and you have to construct them to avoid this kind of awareness. Such stone rings are known from Dion, Claros, Tasos, just to mention a few sites. The calm and solemn sacrifice that we see on the vases and the reliefs, where the animal is waiting next to the altar, was apparently wishful thinking, and reality must have been substantially more noisy and messy, and the animals had to be restrained. The rings also helps to explain a particular kind of coin iconography called the so-called butting bull. They depict the bulls, the heads toward the ground, in a position that is thought to be the animal attacking. But these animals are not animals attacking or charging, and they're not willing victims lowering their heads to be killed. They're rather representations of actual handling of animals in order to facilitate the killing, restraining by a rope and pulling the head towards the ground. The filth that animals generate, both dung and stomach contents, had to be taken care of. As I mentioned last week, the tantalizing and very fragmentary Hecatombenon inscription from Athens states that ontos, the contents of animals' bowels and stomachs, and kopros, dung, should not be disposed of anywhere. And you could not clean out the intestines anywhere where you liked, also, especially not close to the Hecatombenon. On Delos, a late 3rd century BC regulation proclaimed that no one is to dump dung, ash, or anything else within the temenos of Leto. And there are also a number of other documents mentioning the removal of kopros from shrines. Larger quantities of dung would be a problem within a restrained temenos, but we can note en passant that from sacred land uses sacred land uses sacred land used for agricultural purposes, you were not allowed to take away the copros. That was going to stay as fertilizer. On the other hand, the guano collected from the pigeons or delos was even collected and sold. Most of these copros in the inscriptions probably relate to animal dung, I think, but I will come back to this point later. So, after the killing of the animal, the god's part was burnt on the altar, while the rest of the meat butchered, prepared, and consumed. Activities that leave concrete remains, animal bones, that need to be handled. And last week, I tried to show that the bones burnt for the gods on the altars were usually left in place on, near, and inside the altar, or did even form the altar itself. We don't find regulations specifying that the sacrificial debris is perceived as a problem. The fine context of the subarchaeological material, burnt thigh bones, sacrum bones, and tail vertebra, indicate the same pattern, namely that sacrificial debris had to be given a correct treatment inside the temenos. Burnt bones from altars were divine property and should be kept and handled with care and respect. When the god's portion had been burnt and the fire on the altar extinguished, the meat was to be eaten, and this means butchering, cooking, and distribution. The meals that concluded a tusia sacrifice are in fact one of the most common human activities in a temenos, we usually assume. Dining inside the temenos had an impact on the god's space, since you required a particular location. It may be a permanent building or an open field used temporarily. You needed installations for the preparing of the food and equipment for eating it. The meal can be seen as an integrated part of the sacrifice. Still, it's doubtful to what extent men eating after sanctuary inside the god's temenos was an activity that the gods cared about. Diners in a sanctuary would be of little concern for the deity, since this is an activity that takes place after the sacrifice involving the god has been completed or concluded. The size of temene vary greatly, and this is evident from the examples you have seen so far, and of course there are numerous others, but so are also the activities that could and would be accommodated inside. In some cases, there seems only to have been room for the god and his property and needs inside. The worshippers might be something one wanted to control with a temenos wall, and this raises questions of how much room there actually was in Greek sanctuaries for dining and for worshippers dining. Such facilities for banquets are found in many sanctuaries, but a closer look gives at hand that dining inside the temenos, it's not a given fact. If we revisit the temene I mentioned earlier, we see a diverse pattern. At the Hephaestion, the wall, I think, kept the diners outside the garden. And at Olympia, the meal seemed to have taken place either on the west side of the Altis, towards the river Cladeios, or to the east, southeast, where a large number of temporary wells have been found. And even Pindar remarks in the 10th Olympian ode that when Heracles measured out the sanctuary for his father Zeus, he enclosed the Altis, the sacred grove, and marked it off and made the area around a place for feasting. Distribution of the meat at the Olympian Games, however, seems to have taken place inside the Altis, close to the Pelopion, if we judge from the number of weights that have actually been found precisely in this region. At Isthmia, dining took place near the altar, inside the temenos, but was in the archaic period moved to the southwest, where a large pit, a formerly reservoir, was used for dumping both bones and pottery. And in the sanctuary of Poseidon at Calavreia, the temenos seems to have been extended at the end of the archaic period, perhaps to house the diners inside. Where the butchering of the animals took place is little known in most cases. And I here want to retrace what I said about the inscription from Aetolia last week. After a stimulating discussion with Stella Jurgudi and Denis Rosset, for which I'm very grateful, it's evident that these documents speak of me apostevan ento hero, which is best translated as do not debone, désossé, or butcher in the sanctuary. This prohibition most likely refers to animals that were to be eaten, but were had nothing to do with the actual sacrificial victims. And we know from the bones recovered in Greek sanctuaries that not all animals consumed there were sacrificed at the altar. Many animals were brought to be killed for food or even slaughtered at home or in the market. This is evident from the fact that some species eaten, like pigs, wild animals, and dogs, don't appear among the bones burnt on the altar, only in the leftovers from the meals. Isthmia is a very clear case where you can see that the bones burnt on the altar are cattle, sheep, and goats, while the dinner debris from the large pit to the southwest contain the same animals, but in larger numbers, but also pigs and dogs, at least a dog. What the inscription in Aetolia probably regulates is the butchery for purely human reasons. Animal bones from meals in sanctuary context often show that the lower parts of the legs and the top of the heads are not very numerous, and probably these pieces were discarded first in initial division. And this might be what the apostevein inscription is getting at. Cooking fires can also cause damage. There were bans on lighting fires in sanctuaries, presumably due to danger of causing destruction, but also making the place dirty. The Hecatompedon inscription is anxious about the use of fire on the Acropolis. And also in the portico of the Taras of Attalos I at Delphi, fire was not to be lit. And of course, we all know the stories about temple fires. And these cooking fires might have contributed to this kind of problem, but there will also be soot and ash and stuff lying around. Eating results in garbage, at least we would label it waste. And in my former talk, I tried to demonstrate that it's far too simplistic to approach the archaeological record of Greek temene, just seeing this as garbage. In many instances, the bones left after the actual meals were not cleared away, but deposited inside the sanctuary or its very close vicinity, together with pottery, votives, and other offerings as a kind of commemoration of the communication with the gods. But dining also results in other kinds of matter than bones after the meat has been consumed. When people eat and drink, they have to go to the bathroom. So, some of the kopros mentioned in the regulations dealing with the purity of sanctuaries may in fact have had human origin. The handling of human waste, excrements and urine must have been a major issue at festivals, which had to be dealt with in the correct manner. Plutarch, for example, states that one is to avoid urinating against the altar or against the god's building, a declaration which, surprisingly enough, indicates that people would be prone to do so even inside a temenos. Latrines are not found in Greek sanctuaries and rarely also even in the Roman period. And the worshippers presumably had to resort to chamber pots for their needs. And there is even a particular ceramic shape for this purpose. A story preserved by several late antique sources, Suda, for example, tells of this dilemma. The Rhodians, the story goes, were apparently worried about bodily needs in sanctuaries and asked an oracle what kind of chamber pots, of bronze or of clay, they were to bring for the banquets when that took place in the sanctuary of Athena after they have sacrificed to her. The god answered, none of them. A regular sacrifice and the following meal cannot have been a too lengthy affair, but festivals could also mean that people traveled there for a longer period of time. Staying inside the temenos, especially stoas, was regulated, this we know, since it could cause problems, both risks of fire and the general messiness, also this kind of problems I just mentioned. A decree from the sanctuary of Dionysus at Knidos from the mid-4th century explicitly prohibits people from living inside the Hieron. at Chalcedon, a priest of Asclepius, was to keep the porticos clean. And here we may imagine that it's the waste of the incubants that has to be taken care of. And this is a really interesting problem that needs much more attention, I think. In particular, particular concerns regard actual living, not just staying for a short period due to the cult, but living in sanctuaries. And this was discouraged, as long-time residence in a temenos would lead not only to human waste and fires and the mismanagement of the god's property, but perhaps also to sex, birth, and death. A well-known example in Thucydides are the Athenians who fortified the Delion in Boeotia and now lived there, using it and doing there what men do in a profane place, and Bebeloi, Thucydides says. And we could just suspect what kind of activities that entitles. They were even drawing the water that was reserved to the Chernips in connection with sacrifice, Thucydides comments. And this handling of water is also a particular issue that also deserves much more study. If there was special, to what extent do you actually have water in sanctuaries that is particularly reserved to the gods, and to what extent is the water there for the worshippers? Plato in the Laws speaks of the examiners residing in the temenos of Helios and Apollo as long as they're holding office, but it's difficult to tell to what extent this reflects reality. The question is to what extent religious personnel would actually live inside the temenos and not just outside it. So, where have all of this led us? The delimitation of divine space varied greatly between locations and periods, as well as the character of the cult, but a clear temenos border was never a prerequisite for a sanctuary. Moreover, a temenos wall seems to be a human concern more than a divine one. The god apparently did not need a proper wall. This was a concern only for the humans who took care of the god's sanctuary and the cult in the correct way. Once inside the temenos, there was also responsibility for the human visitors. Men can use sanctuary's gods, but only to a certain extent, and there is a constant policing to prevent transgressions. It's clear that agricultural use of a temenos does not seem to have affected the sacred status of the land. When coming to a sanctuary to sacrifice, eating and drinking is fine in most cases, but sometimes the god's temenos does not accommodate the worshippers' meals. They have to be on the outside, since it's too small, and or reserved for the god's own property and needs. The mortal visitors cannot use all water for their needs. Fire needs to be restricted. Sleeping there is kept to a minimum and for particular purposes. And of course, you have to keep track of your animals at all time, no matter if they are to be sacrificed or just transport animals. Toilets in the temenos does not seem like an option. In a way, the worshippers are to behave as any guest would, respectfully, not to offend the host or damage the host property, tidying up and keeping the place clean and respecting the borders. After all, Greek gods liked beautiful things, agalmata, and among these things we should definitely include the beautifully and appropriately kept temenos. Thank you.